Today's podcast is brought to you by WarbyParker.com. Get a free 5-day home try-on at WarbyParkerTrial.com/FilmWaxRadio. 5 pairs, 5 days, 100% free.
You're listening to Film Wax Radio, hosted by Adam Shartoff.
Welcome, everybody, to episode number 359 of Film Wax Radio. My name is Adam Shartoff. I'm your host, and we're going to have a very special show coming up today. And friends are going to stop by to help to introduce these segments. As I've said before, historically, I've always done these intros alone in the confines of my bedroom. That's too much information already, right? Or my car, wherever I happen to be. This is something new as a footnote. I will be stuck in traffic, and I will actually do intros.
Really?
As I'm stuck. Yeah, because there's so little to do, and I realize this is a better use of my time than
it's very true.
Just listening to some jerk who has a podcast over the radio, over my radio. So I start doing intros. I'm just wondering what it's like for people in a car going by and seeing this guy with headphones and a mic and steering the car at the same time. The laughter you're hearing is from Charlotte Williams, who is the official Film Wax Radio intern.
Hello.
Hi.
Once again.
Yeah. Are you close enough to the mic?
Hello, once again.
Oh, that's better. Thank you. Anyway.
Put him through some
I
tests.
Have to get into better habits. Again, I'm sitting in a car. Yeah. I'm sitting in a car with my microphone with the red, little ball on the top where you filters out the P's and the T's and all. And I'm doing some of the intros in my car because I can't. I think it's a great use of the time. But here we are in the studio, and so this is much more preferable, of course. So thank you. So I'm trying to get into all these new habits. But another thing that being in the studio affords me now, of course, is having other people visit even during these intros. So thank you for coming in.
Happy to be here.
How's your summer going?
My summer's going well. Mm-hmm. I've been here back from school for a while now. Mm-hmm. So,
are you getting, not spoiled, but maybe complacent here? Like, are you going to be able to?
Well, I think I will perhaps maybe feel that way when I go back to school. But right now, I've never had this much time off between years, academic years.
Oh, so. Right. Because it's at least a month longer than like your grade schools.
I would say about summers. A month and a half. I would have, a year ago last week, I graduated high school.
So shocking.
Yeah. It's a
You're
little
so
weird.
Mature.
Oh, thank you.
Are we starting to pressure you into transferring to Columbia or NYU or I don't even care. It could also be in theater, right? Mm-hmm. As we know. So you could transfer into, there's probably a number of other schools that, of higher learning that focus on theater.
There are definitely a couple here in New York, but I think it's as much as I love it here. It was nice to get away for a little bit, so can't trick me into that yet.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we started, actually, we were talking informally about that you just went to see Taming of the Shrew.
Yes.
At Theater in the Park, and that you really enjoyed that as an all female cast. And then you were just about to say something that, and I raced to start the program because I think this is worth us talking about on the show, and that is the new Ira Sachs film. Now, Ira is a filmmaker who has been on this podcast at least twice before. I know him somewhat. I was an extra on his last film, which was called Love is Strange.
Oh, yes, with Oliver Platt, I think.
No, but an actor that might remind I could see why you...
Maybe.
With Alfred Molina.
Oh, it is Alfred Molina. Okay, he's in this one too.
Right, Little Men, exactly, the new film. The scene that I was in the last movie, Love is Strange, was in a gay bar in the West Village, just around the corner.
Pieces, probably? Is it Pieces?
I don't think, it was named after, it was like, I know I'm going to say the wrong thing and sound. No, it said some man's name, Julian's.
Oh, I don't know it.
I think it's called Julian's. Right. I may be wrong, but I think it was called. And I was seated at the bar. Like, Ira came over and says, come over here. And he pulled me over, of all the people in the room, and one other person, and we sat next to Alfred Molina and John Lithgow. Are you listening? Are you listening, Alex? Isn't John Lithgow one of the greats? He's a great actor. And these two guys played lovers, you know, long-time companions.
Yeah.
And they had this scene in this towards the end of the film in this gay bar. And I was seated next to them and one other guy.
Yeah.
And I just thought, this is fantastic. I'm just going to be in this entire scene. I'm just going to keep looking over at the camera going,
hi, Mom.
Waving.
Yeah.
Hi, Mom. Exactly.
Look at me.
No, I knew a little bit better not to do that, but
sure.
but I thought, I'm going to be in the shot. I'm not. You see my ear at one point. That's about it. They just shot. I just happened to be the way they framed it. But what I did get out of that experience, Charlotte, was the opportunity to watch two great actors practicing their craft.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. And Alfred was nice. I talked to them both at length at various parts of the evening. I got a shot of Alfred because he played Doc Ock in the original Spider-Man series.
Oh, really?
Dr. Octagon. You don't know about that?
No, I don't.
He was the original Doc Ock in like the first, you know, spinoff with
Tobey
Maguire.
Yeah.
And my kid loved, you know, Spider-Man.
Yeah.
So I thought, let me get a picture of the Doc Ock on,
sure.
You know. So that's that story. Now, flash forward to more recently, there's the new film, and they're doing a retrospective of Ira's films to date, which he's made about a half dozen features.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to be doing a retrospective at, I think, I'm forgetting, but I think MoMA. I could be wrong. But anyway, the point being, I asked if I could get... Yeah, I think it was MoMA.
I think you did say the MoMA.
I think it's MoMA.
Yeah,
yeah, because anyway, it looks as though Ira will be doing an interview here again, in studio, I hope, for a lengthier chat about his career and about everything else. And so I think he's a real, you know, great filmmaker. But so you saw it?
I did.
Little Men. What did you think?
I thought it was really sweet. And it was kind of funny because they mention, you know, it's kind of follows these two young boys, and one of them says, oh, I want to be an actor and I want to audition for LaGuardia High School. And I was like, oh, well, that's where I went to high school. It was really kind of funny because I didn't really think, like, you know, something so close to me would be mentioned or anything like that. And I thought it was kind of funny.
Yeah. Ira, if I'm not mistaken, the filmmaker, lives just like a block away from you guys, your parents. He lives, I gotta skip the address, of course, but I believe he lives like right off Fifth Avenue.
Oh.
Like right over there.
Right around
I kind of think I know the address.
Yeah.
And I know this too, because for many, many years, my parents also lived right around the corner there on Fifth Avenue.
Right.
And then I lived pretty close by for many years. Mm-hmm. And his films a lot of them take place like locally around the village and all
that. It was, I think, mainly...
A lot of that was in Brooklyn, right?
Took place in Brooklyn. I enjoyed it, and I thought it was kind of, it's sort of bittersweet because it follows this friendship that's sort of compromised by, you know, adult manner, like adult issues that can't be sort of met, like...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's at the cost of, you know, their parents.
Right.
I think that's kind of sad. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, there sort of were these two young boys who become friends through their parents.
Yeah.
And they also struggle to, you know, to keep their friendship going because of the conflicts that end up happening between their parents. And, yeah, it's an interesting thing because it's really the most critical thing I could say is you can't rely on it being too much of a character study, nor can you rely on it to be too much of a the story, the narrative, because it's kind of light in both ways, yet there seems to still be such a craftsmanship to the filmmaking and such a good acting all around that you're still invested in it.
Yeah.
But it's normal that you would get really, really close and figure something really deeply out about like a character in a film like this, and you don't.
Right, because I think it kind of is... I mean, I would say that the largest character study is around one of the young boys. His name, I think, is Jake.
Mm-hmm.
But it does sort of split focus between, you know, the other small boy, and then each of the parents have their own sort of story that affects, you know, everything that goes on within the larger plot, which I think is the reason why that's the case.
So. Yeah. Well, I'm also grateful that even though we mentioned Alfred Molina's in it, he plays a fairly small supporting role in it. It was probably like a day's work I'm assuming.
Probably. You know? Yeah.
Whereas, like, Greg Kinnear is really the big name in this
film. Yeah,
yeah. Which is kind of nice. It was a Greg Kinnear you don't see too often.
Right.
He played it, you know, it was the most impressive thing I've seen him in. And I'm sure he's done other things as good, but I just haven't seen him. You know, because he tends to do big budget Hollywood films, which I, you know, which I might see, but I may not as well.
Yeah.
So this was nice to see him do something like this.
I only know Alfred Molina from, I know he did the, not the current revival, but the past revival of Fiddler on the Roof on Broadway.
Oh,
so that's
did
how
you go
I knew.
To that?
I didn't. I had never seen it until, but I had seen like videos and I'm almost 100% sure he played Tevye. And you were talking about him, you know, before, and I think it's cool to see that he's doing film and Broadway and has this sort of variety in his career. It's nice.
Do you know who Zero Mostel is?
Yes. Okay. He originated the role on Broadway.
Was he the first? Yeah, I don't know. But if he wasn't, he's the one that kind of made the, like, you know, a huge success. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were a couple of it's very well possible. Anyway, he didn't do the movie, though.
No.
There was, I forget
Topol?
The name. Topol. Yeah, that's correct. Wow, you are. It's refreshing to know that. I mean, this is something I would normally have known when I was your age. But like that kind of stuff, even though it was also closer to in time to when I was your age.
Right.
I mean, the point being is like I was also like this, had this memory, and also just an interest in that type of. And when I was 19, I saw a lot of theater in New York. It was very, very inexpensive at the time. Even Broadway was very affordable for anybody. You know, like I didn't have a lot of money, but I didn't have any real expenses either. So I could go see something.
Yeah.
And you could go and see, you don't care if you're in the balcony when you're or standing room when you're 19.
Or not at all.
So to go at a chance to see some. So I've seen some amazing performances. And my high school, even though we were a public school in Queens, we also would come in. My theater class would come in and see stuff on Broadway. Mm-hmm.
That's so nice. I try and see as much as I can while I'm here. But, you know, it's hard because now it's definitely more expensive. But there are ways to see it.
For sure. Yeah. And there's probably more alternatives to Broadway.
Yes.
Where they're really, I hate to say it, but a lot of the best theater is going to be anyway. Because, you know, Broadway, when I was growing up, was pretty serious theater. A lot of original dramatic plays by some of the greatest playwrights that were living.
Right.
And now, no disrespect, but it's a lot of spectacle with big stars in order to pay the bills.
Right.
So it's a lot. And so you have to kind of look to off-Broadway and other theaters to figure, you know, see some of the serious new works that are coming out. But I'm so glad you got to see the film. And there is a lot more I can certainly get to you if you're interested. I'm glad you did see that because at least that one, I think, was definitely a strong film.
Mm-hmm.
And again, hopefully we'll have Ira in here. And if he comes in, I'll, of course, invite you in.
Oh, that'd be great.
And hopefully we'll confirm it. They said pencil in the 14th of July.
All right.
So it could.
I'll pencil it.
Yeah, and I just have to get Alex to also agree to that date. But on today's show, once again, this is actually a very great show. You were here for one of the segments I'm posting on today's show.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember Joel Fendelman?
I do.
With the hair?
Yes.
And Frank Hall Green?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're going to play that segment momentarily. They have a film that was at the Brooklyn Film Festival, and I believe it won some awards. It was called Remittance.
Mm-hmm.
I think they ended up doing well with it there. And Remittance is a great... Did you see it?
I didn't get a chance to see it.
I can make that available to you. Great. I think you'll really enjoy that. There's no actors you will know in this film. This is mostly shot with Filipino actors and Singapore.
Oh,
so,
cool.
So you may or may not, you won't recognize, I don't think, if there's any professional actors in there, I don't know about it, but it's a great film. So I will send that to you so you can watch Remittance if you wish.
Yeah, I like that.
It is going to be at that Stony Brook Film Festival.
Oh.
So Joel Fendelman, who was on the show before with the film called David, he was on a number of years ago. He's returning. He's the director of this movie, Remittance, and the producer on the film is Frank Hall Green, who was also on this podcast before, and that was when he was a director with a film called Wildlike, which is now on Netflix, streaming on Netflix.
Oh, it is. I watched the trailer for it, and it looked really interesting.
It is so good.
I'm glad
you should watch
it. I will.
You should watch that one. Yeah, it's with Bruce Greenwood.
Okay. I don't know. I'm not.
Oh, he's a great actor. Oh, you will recognize him. He's in so many things. He was on the last few episodes of Mad Men.
Oh, okay.
Did you watch that?
I am on season 3.
Okay.
So I'm behind, but yeah.
Anyway, you will, when you get up to the final episodes, he has a recurring role. But he's also was on one of the Star Trek series, and he was also in he's been in a lot of like endless movies.
Oh, okay.
Endless films. He's really good.
Him.
He looks like a slightly younger Robert Redford. Like he's not slightly. He looks like a younger Robert Redford.
Right.
But he himself is not. He's sort of a middle-aged guy.
Sure.
But he's what a wonderful guy. And he came on. He did the show too, Bruce.
Cool.
But Frank Hall Green was directing that, and that's how. And Frank came on the show, and he did that, and he told this one, which we're going to talk about during the segment coming up. He told me about this time he was stabbed on the streets of New York City.
Oh my.
So you should go back and listen to find that original show because he tells it in great detail, that anecdote.
All right.
Yeah. So those two guys are going to be coming up. And then do you know who else we have on this coming episode?
Tell me.
But I'm going to wait for Kevin to walk in. So there's a cliffhanger right there.
Oh, my gosh. I'm on the edge of my seat. Not really because I'm quite comfortable in these chairs. But
Well, Charlotte and I are being joined by my friend Kevin Davidson. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, how are you?
Do you know for like 5 years, I haven't been able to get Herbert on the show, but okay, I've not asked him.
That's right. You know it's what you have to do in order to get him on the show. You have to ask him.
That's right.
Okay.
Kevin, I've invited you on you're a goofball.
Okay.
No.
Thank
but you.
All right. Thanks a lot. I'll take care.
No,
I'm just kidding.
God bless. We've met through film. During one of those film social.
That's true. Shooting people, shooters at the pub, which does not exist as an event anymore, but it does exist as a website, weirdly, because they want to keep the dialogue going
with
other filmmakers, so you can post things and ask questions. And
even 5 years ago, or 4 years ago, around the time when we started going,
yes,
I thought this is not the greatest name for a gathering anymore. I understood the play on words, shooting people, because they're mostly documentary film.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But I still thought, you know, it's just not a great expression. And now I totally feel like, just stop calling this group shooting people, okay? Because
that's funny.
Anyway,
filmy people.
Even though I was a big fan of like people like Ingrid and Cop and who ran it,
and your buddy
and my buddy Jesse Epstein.
Exactly. Jesse Epstein.
You know her.
I know. I just went to. I worked on a film with her, an indie film, years ago, directed by Danny Leiner. It was called Layin' Low. And then we worked on another film. These were films that were produced by the Shooting Gallery, another name that has shooting in
that's
the title.
Right.
So we did shooters.
I forgot
at the
about
pub,
your connection with Shooting Gallery.
Yes. Yeah, so I did location stuff and I did art department stuff.
Rance. What was that guy's name? Rance.
Whitney Rancic.
Whitney Rancic.
Whitney Rancic did a documentary about the Shooting Gallery.
Was James Seamus involved in that?
Those guys, like James Seamus and Ted Hope, sort of were running their own peripheral.
They had their
own
thing.
They were really they kind of captured up the Hal Hartley experience and kind of went with him and they started their own production thing.
I see. Well, James has got a new film and I was debating whether I should invite him on. What do you think? On the show.
Sure,
I mean, he's got a new film he's directed. It's coming out.
Oh,
I'm getting the pre-screenings invitations too.
And that sounds cool. What is it? Is it a narrative?
Mm-hmm.
I was just going to ask you if he has directed a lot of films.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't remember the last time I saw his name, you know, as a director, but I haven't, I don't know.
Randomly, I was looking on Facebook, or I think it was Facebook, and they said, they mentioned something about Ted Hope, and they were like, and you're friends with him. Like, when did I become? Because I don't, like, if you mention my name to him, he would, no, necessarily. I just sort of ran with some of that group.
Well, let's see. Anyway, we're going to get Ted on the phone. Can we do that? Yeah. Well, actually, I emailed his wife, Vanessa, like 2 days ago because I'm a little bit, you know, not intimidated by Ted Hope, but, you know, it's like by the idea of emailing him about what I wanted to email him. So I thought, let me go through Vanessa, who is his wife and who I know and who Ted Hope is a big time
He's a producer.
Indie producer, but now he's now running Amazon Studios.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Oh, is he? And he used to do...
And he was running Fandor.
And he had a pretty close connection with, what's his face? Ang Lee.
Oh, sure.
When produced he did,
the...
He,
wow.
yeah. Hulk and some of these. I don't know whether the Hulk specifically, but there were a lot of movies.
Life of Pi? No.
Didn't Ang Lee do the one about Brokeback Mountain?
Yeah, he did the one about Brokeback Mountain, but not he didn't direct Brokeback Mountain.
That's right. He actually he produced Brokeback Hill, which was the start. It was like a short, and then yeah. And then they got the money.
Which was based on a hate crime against gays.
That's right. Watch out for Brokeback Hill.
That's right. Don't watch that one by accident.
Sorry. Do not listen to any of this as fact. These are jokes, but.
Anyway, even though I just had Todd Solondz, I'd like you to see Wiener Dog.
All right.
That's a real film.
I believe
it's,
you.
It's a comedy, and it's a great film. It's out now. It's a beautiful comedy, and I talked to Todd on the phone, but I want to invite him to come into the studio and have a real sit-down.
So you interviewed him and have a second podcast? On that. Okay.
Yeah. It went up on the last episode, so you probably remember that because you listened.
Oh, yes, that's right. Oh, Todd Solondz. That's right.
Okay. Todd Solondz. Back for his second appearance on the podcast.
Okay.
But I want to get him in the studio and talk to him at length because he's so great, and he's such a nerd. I mean, he's so nerdy.
One of the things that I notice about pretty much every film of his that I've seen is that they start out with, they take you in one direction and then they just completely flip everything around. I don't know if you remember, like in Welcome to the Dollhouse. Have you ever seen Welcome to the Dollhouse? There's a whole setup with Dawn Wiener and how, like, you think something's going to happen and then something else happens. And there was something very similar
They bring Dawn Wiener back.
They bring, right. I know that that's sort of the idea or continuation or something, mm-hmm. something to do with the dog. So they kind of go in one direction and they kind of bring you.
Right.
And then they flip everything.
They don't
around.
Do that here. These are vignettes. No? This is like a series of vignettes of these different owners of this dog.
Oh, okay.
And it's a lot of comedy and a little bit of like, you know, weightiness to a couple of the things that happen, but it's generally speaking a really just probably is least controversial or demanding in the, you know.
Yeah, I do know what you mean.
Saying that makes me feel a little bit, you know, like I'm criticizing when I say least demanding, but some of his films are way demanding. Even though they're comedies, they get very they're really dark.
I don't think that's unfair to say that they can be demanding. It's not for everybody.
No, it's that not, way. It's not like you should see the. So start with Welcome to the Dollhouse, and then you can work your way through. I'm a big fan of also Dark Horse, which was like, you know, nobody saw.
I didn't see that.
But I have a copy of that. It's just so wonderful to watch. It's so wonderful. It's about a guy, you know, living with his parents and just hates his, you know, such a difficult relationship with his parents. It's like, and his father's played by Christopher Walken.
Wow.
Yeah. And
Dark Horse. I have to see that.
Yeah. It's really good. And Mia Farrow plays his mother, the guy's mother. You know, it's a good
cast. How long ago was that?
3 years.
Oh, okay.
I want to say it was his last film.
Oh, okay.
And it's, I have a DVD of it.
Oh, interesting. Well, I just was remembering that. Remember storytelling?
Of course.
Okay. And so you remember in the very beginning of the film, Selma Blair goes to the door and she's knocking and this guy comes up and he's got like MS or something. He's something wrong. He's physically challenged and he's like, and then he proceeds to, and so you think like, oh my God, she's got this relationship with this guy, and you sort of are sympathizing with him and you want, I don't know. It's just,
she's in Dark Horse too, by the way.
And then he turns around and he's like, I don't want to go out with you cause you're pathetic.
In other words,
he rejects her hard.
Right.
And it's just one of these things where it's like, oh my God. So he kind of brings you, it's deliberate. You know, he brings you to this certain place where you think one thing and then he's like, no, I'm going to bring you down.
No, he's a really terrific. I said it to him. I said, you know, you're I think one of the, you know, great filmmakers, but I don't know how he even has it as much of an audience as he has. I mean, and I think it's slowly, each time he comes out with a new film, I think it actually, I wouldn't be surprised if his audience is diminishing, just because, you know, that's what happens unless you make some commercial successes.
Right.
People just don't, I don't know.
I think it's kind of unfortunate, though.
I agree with you.
Continue.
You're right.
It's
empathetic. It's an empathic comment, and I agree with you. I agree. I'm very loyal, though. I'm very loyal to filmmakers. I don't think there's a lot of loyalty in this country about things like that. Before you came in, we were talking about Iris Axe, who has a new film called Little Men, which we both watched, Charlotte and I watched. Yeah. And I'm getting Iris Axe in here, fingers crossed, in about 2 weeks.
Okay.
So that's another great, I think, great emerging filmmaker. When I say emerging, I mean to the more general public.
Yeah.
So we were talking about that, and then I was also mentioning this first one of the segments is coming up in a little while, which is with a filmmaker named Joel Fendelman and his producer Frank Hall Green, and their film is called Remittance, and we're going to go see it to the we're going to go to Stony Brook Film Festival, which I've never gone to, but I've heard really good things about. Have you ever been to that?
No, never.
I didn't even get to the Brooklyn Film Festival or BAM Cinema Fest this summer, which is like a first in years. But I'm going to go to the Stony Brook.
Where were you? Yeah.
Working, just working. Oh. And I also had my kid until just a couple of days ago. I brought him to L.A. So I every night I had to go home and feed the son of a bitch. every night, dinner, please. It's like, come on.
He eats food. He keeps eating food.
Over and over.
What's up with that?
What's going on?
Well, they have this new stuff. It's called,
selfish.
It's called Soylent.
I've heard of Soylent.
You know, you have, right? Do you know what I'm talking about? No, it's actually
a Charlton Heston reference.
No, there is a thing called Soylent, and it's like this liquid, like ground up everything and it contains everything you need. And so
I see
they're aiming it towards people who just cannot stop working. Seriously,
bad. It's supporting bad behavior, and but I understand there's money to be made off of it. So why not? I wish I had invented it myself.
It's fashionable.
The other
episode was sponsored by Soylent. Keep on working. Sorry.
That's right. For God's sake. I can't do Charlton Heston. Clearly. The other segment, though, is Roger Ross Williams. Do you know who that is?
No, I don't.
All right. It's okay that you don't, because he's not a widely known documentary filmmaker. But Roger Ross Williams is going to go down in the history books for something that he accomplished that no other person like him has accomplished, which we do talk about in the segment. He has a new documentary. It's currently in theaters. It's called Life Animated, or it's going to be in theaters, this Friday. It's been a hit at all the big festivals. I saw it at Tribeca.
Okay.
And it's about a young autistic boy named Owen, son of a gun. I'm just forgetting for a second. But anyway, he's autistic, and his parents are these super successful, wonderful parents. They realized their son had autism, and the son was slowly withdrawing into himself and disappearing. And then, by accident, one night, the father goes into the bedroom of the little boy, and he takes a doll, which was a sidekick from one of the Disney films, and he starts to imitate the sidekick, this doll, his voice.
Like bring him to life.
Which was Gilbert Gottfried's voice. Yeah, and the kids says something. And the more they do this, the more the kid starts to come out of himself. And what they realize is that the kid has been memorizing all the Disney films that he's watched. And they start engage him as all the different characters. And the kid comes out of and starts to become more socialized.
Oh.
And and a lot of it is all being launched by the memorization of all these. Like, he's memorized every single Disney film ever made. And he watches them, of course, obsessively on some level, but it has brought the kid back to life for these parents. And now the kid is a young adult. And I mean, the film follows him over the course of a few years, and he's living independently. And he was at the screening I went to. He's supporting the film with the filmmakers. It's an incredible story.
Great.
And it's called Life Animated.
Wow.
And it's hitting theaters this weekend. So I know I sold you two on it.
Very interesting.
And the director's name is Roger Ross Williams. Now, Roger made a film a couple of years ago, a documentary, which was also very well received, called God Loves Uganda.
Okay.
Which I know I saw, but I'm thinking, if I remember correctly, it was about homophobia in this part of Africa, which is not just in that part of Africa, but there's a lot of intolerance and violence against homosexuals in Africa. But Roger made a short film, even short documentary before that, which earned him an Oscar.
Oh, okay.
Roger Ross Williams is the first African-American director to win an Oscar.
Oh, wow.
That's what he's noted for. Wow. Well, I mean, among making two very successful documentaries.
So when did he win that Oscar?
I don't know.
Like a few years
I'll look it up, but it's within the last 5 years, 6 years. Yeah. I mean, maybe a little somewhere really recently.
I'm wondering whether I had heard about that or something.
But anyway. But you would have thought, right? It was like, Steve McQueen or or Sidney Poitier Roger Ross Williams is the first.
He won in 2010.
Okay, very. So exactly right where we said. So yeah. That means that the film was probably about 7 years old.
Okay,
and he got the Oscar for that short film. Then he was shortlisted.
And what
for,
was that film? That was what you found out.
The name of the short? Yeah.
Hold on. It was Music by Prudence.
Music by Prudence.
Okay, okay, look it up. Let's see. I'm sure you could watch that. It's an Oscar-winning short documentary.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he won the. Can you imagine that he won in 2000? What year?
10.
2010.
2010. A black director. When was the first? He was the first.
Right.
Isn't that shocking?
Yeah, kind of.
It's really unacceptable. We go into it a little bit into the. It's hard. It was on a phone, so I don't like.
So that means Spike Lee never won.
That's what that means.
Well, just because I know that he was pushing for, you know,
yeah,
it was a big deal. He made a lot of, you know, fairly high profile films at the time. But
absolutely.
Yeah.
No, I mean a lot of.
There's also strange. I mean, we can go into a larger conversation, and I won't get too much into it. But there is a something about, well, now it's this person's turn, and within the Oscar setup, because it's like, oh, that was great, and that one's great, and that one's great.
It's usually,
but you are getting, because this one is like the. But you guys keep going,
and it's not necessarily based on the best quality work so much as it's just your turn.
I don't want to be totally. I don't want to be totally cynical about it.
No, it's not cynical. We've seen it many times. Like all the, you know, didn't.
Pacino
won for
Scent
of a Woman,
and that was weird. And everybody said that was weird.
This is the guy that made Author. Right. No, I'm kidding. This is the guy that should have won for.
It was like Dog Day Afternoon.
Dog Day Afternoon or Serpico, or
right.
Choose a Godfather.
Year, yeah. So then they're like, we got to give him something.
I would have given Al Pacino an Oscar for Glengarry Glen Ross. That's how much I like that rendition.
Right, but that was.
Yeah, but anyway, it's another great film you need to see.
Yeah, that one's been on my.
Yeah, I have a copy of that too. You will just remind me, and I'll I'm sure you can rent these things, but I don't know. You have to have a lot of different subscriptions. The first segment. Okay, let's go into my conversation with Roger Ross Williams. As I always said, he's the director of Life Animated, which is opening Friday in New York, in L.A., and I bet other cities. But it's going to be opening wider over the coming weeks for sure. The following Friday, et cetera, et cetera. And again, Oscar-winning documentary filmmaker Roger Ross Williams.
There is a boy who is just like other boys. Until one night, he sees from his window a storm on the horizon.
Howie, who are you?
I'm Peter
Pan,
and you?
All of a sudden, at 3 years old, Owen vanishes. The doctor says, let me explain what autism is. Some of the kids don't ever talk again.
I remember thinking, I'm just going to hold you so tight and love you so much that whatever is going on will go away.
We're beginning to give up hope. And one day, we're watching the Disney animated movies. And he says he doesn't want to grow up like Mowgli or Peter Pan. And all of a sudden it became clear to us. He's using these movies to make sense of the world he actually is living in, our world. So at that point, we began to speak to him in Disney dialogue.
When did you and I become such good friends?
Whatever works to get to Owen.
I've been scared my whole life of growing up. Peter Pan doesn't want to grow up because when you grow up, you lose all your magical childhood times.
Hi, Roger. Hi, Roger. How are you? Hi.
Good.
I was just going to ask Teresa real fast, just to remind me, make sure I knew the opening of the theatrical, but we can talk about that. You know.
July 1st.
Thank you. Oh, you're still there. Okay. Listening in covertly. Okay. Hi, Roger. Sorry about that. How are you?
Hi.
Hi.
I'm great.
Great, good. Great is good.
Yeah.
I saw Life Animated at the Tribeca Film Festival, the one where everybody in the entire cast and crew and New York City showed up.
That was our New York. I guess that was our New York premiere.
Yeah, it was in the Battery Park City. You know, the Theater, Cinemaplex. Yeah. It was fabulous. It was a great time. It was a great conversation. I had seen Gilbert Gottfried in the bathroom just moments before, and I thought he was going to that. There was a short documentary about him or something also, and I thought, that's odd.
There was?
I think there was I think there was something about him. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Anyway, so, but once I realized that he was a sidekick. Yes. But once I realized that he was a Disney sidekick, you see, it all came together. Then it made complete sense. And I should also just
very
get out.
Very influential.
Mm-hmm, go ahead.
A very important sidekick to Owen.
Oh, that's right. He's in the movie, and it's fantastic. It's such an entertaining part. Yeah, it's just in so many ways so much fun to watch. One other piece of business is that I grew up going to summer camp with Julie Goldman. I'll let that soak in. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That summer camp, you know, that summer camp is really famous because didn't Akiva go there as well?
Goldsmith.
The Hollywood producer.
That sounds familiar. That sounds familiar. We had so many
people. Yeah, he produced Beautiful Mind and the Superman movies and lots of films. And
I am not 100%.
He hosted our, he went there as well. He hosted our L.A.
Camp
one Thoreau. Of our meetings in L.A.
Yeah, Camp Thoreau. Also, a little later on, A.O. Scott.
Yeah.
A.O. Scott. But many other people, too. Many other people.
No way!
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, this camp just turned out all the brilliant people of the world.
I'd like to think so, but I may be an...
including yourself.
I may be...
Julie's absolutely amazing.
really, truly. I was reading over the notes, you know, the press notes also, and it said something about, it was actually you had to kind of get through a level of discomfort initially, even though, of course, Owen, who is the main subject of the film, Owen Susskind, is charming and funny and all these great things, but still you had some level of discomfort around the subject of autism or people with autism. Is that true? And was that something that... You know, you had to grapple with?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I didn't know anyone living with autism when I started the film. You know, I knew Owen very, very, you know, I didn't really know him very well, and even though I was friends with Ron for a long time and friends with the family, and so for me it was about this sort of, you know, I was uncomfortable in the beginning, but... I think, you know, which was a really good thing because I think the way the arc of the film works is that the audience, when you meet Owen for the first time, he's self-talking and pacing around and you're uncomfortable and you don't know what he's saying, you don't know what he's doing. And then by the end of the film, you know, you totally understand what Owen is saying. You totally understand. You're completely immersed in his world. And so for me, it was important to tell the story from the inside looking out, from Owen's point of view, and not from the outside looking in, and to really get into his head. So as I sort of, you know, peeled off the layers and understanding who Owen is, it changed my perception of people living with autism, and I have been so enriched because of it.
That's a nice residual.
Yeah.
Takeaway.
That's the great thing about being a documentarian. You get to learn, you get to go into these worlds, and you get to challenge yourself and learn things that you normally wouldn't have, you know, learned, and you get to become, you know, an expert on things that interest you. So I love what I do.
Is it true that you are the first African American director to win an Oscar?
Yes, isn't that? I mean, it's shocking but true.
Shocking. I wouldn't even say but true.
Think,
I would
you
say
would
and
think
true. Yeah,
that would have happened. But, you know, we live in not so diverse a world, especially the world of Hollywood, and yes.
Did Steve McQueen... go ahead.
Hopefully that will change.
Oh, I hope so, too, and I think so. I mean, it seems to be an incredibly slow process, but
yes.
You know, as the last, I guess, Oscar award season proved, people are kind of running out of patience and seems to be a lot more empathy around this subject than ever. You know.
Yes, it is. It is a process. It's, you know, I mean, I think with Hollywood, it's, you know, it's just that there's just not a lot of diversity in the people who make the decisions, you know?
Sure.
And, you know, hopefully that, that's going to change.
Yeah. Then you did God Loves Uganda?
God Loves Uganda, yeah.
Yeah, yes, okay, very good, okay. And then you were all, you were shortlisted. You must have had, you must have been thinking, oh, this is kind of crazy. I can't, I don't want to win another Oscar. That would be bad. That, you know, then people will hate me. No, I'm, I, you know, I'm kidding. But think of all the resentment that would be.
No, no, I won. I, you know, it, the, you don't go into a film thinking, oh, I'm going to win an Oscar, or I want to win an Oscar even. You go into a film because, I mean, God Loves Uganda I made because it was a very personal issue to me.
Sure.
You know, being, growing up in the church and being a gay man growing up in a non-affirming church. So it was like, you know, it was like personal to me. And then, yeah, getting shortlisted was a, you know, a bonus, an added bonus. And, you know, yeah.
How young were you when you identified as gay? And I'm asking in the context of what you're talking about in terms of church and, you know, if you heard language that made you feel badly. Or where
oh,
you?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh no, I heard. I identified as far back as I can remember, really. And I always, it was a secret that people, you know, sort of catch on to, and you have sort of, you know, not only the church preaching against it, but people in my family who are saying, "Man up! You're sissy. You're too." Feminine, or you're too, you know. So it was really sort of rejection and feeling like an outsider. And I think that's why every film I make is sort of dealing with that, whether it's God Bless Uganda or Music by Prudence or Life Animated. It's about feeling like a sidekick, like the other.
That's right. I could see that you could, though maybe it wasn't that obvious at first, but maybe you could identify with Owen, at least on some level. And also Ron, his dad, who is, you know, this incredible guy, and not in any way to diminish his mother. I mean, holy cow, she's just, Cornelia, is that her name? She's just unbelievable.
Cornelia, yeah.
Yeah, they're just such
an amazing mom.
Just exceptional parents. And so, but I could understand also why you would have been drawn to a dad, you know, it was a professional relationship, but it sounds like you also became quite friendly. This is somebody who, you know, I could just see, like, the way they support their son could be very appealing, you know. Yeah. I could understand that appeal to you.
It was very appealing because, for me, this was a story about love and family. And while I had a very loving mother, I did not have a father, and I was just a single mother. And I didn't have that sort of nuclear family experience. And so this was a powerful story of family and a powerful story of love, sort of, you know, love so strong that it overcame a huge, and because of that love, they found a pathway to their son.
It's really, really just was an astonishing thing. I mean, for those listening who, you know, I mean, it seems like he had shut down to the degree, Owen, their son, had withdrawn developmentally and, you know, with language and whatnot, to the point where he was almost disappearing completely, correct? And then it was when they accidentally kind of discovered that he was enacting some of the dialogue, right, from one of his favorite Disney movies, right? And then it just, from there, they encouraged that. And then that just blossomed into, you know, just an amazing alternate identity.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
A way of communicating.
Yeah, they all became Disney animated characters, and really had to, you know, as Owen says, these films live in him. They had to sort of, you know, live in these films in order to get to their son. So they were speaking Disney dialogue around the house, and, you know, that moment when Ron first discovered that with the Iago puppet, when he goes into Owen's room and he takes the Iago puppet and speaks to him in the voice of Gilbert Gottfried, that was just like a light bulb went off, and that's when they realized that they could speak to him in Disney dialogue and they could connect.
Well, you said earlier that you had known Ron, again, Owen's dad, who was a New York Times journalist and an author in his own right, and that he had written this book, which I guess your documentary is, you know, I guess you could say, based on. When did you enter into Owen's life as the filmmaker? At what point?
This started before the book came out. Ron and I, you know, have known each other for a long time. And so Ron, when he was writing the book, he said, you know, I think this would make a great documentary. And he told me about Owen and Disney Club. I remember he told me about Disney Club and he sort of, you know, Ron being an amazing storyteller, sort of described the scene in Disney Club of them watching these classic Disney animated films and using them as a guide for life and analyzing them. And when a light bulb went off, and I thought, oh my God, this is an amazing film. And I remember I called my producer, Julie Goldman, pretty much right after meeting, and we were off and running. So it was pretty early on, before the book came out, that I started filming.
And how soon did you realize that you were going to, you know, have to deal with rights for Disney clips and whatever else you had to navigate? And how quick? I mean, this is, I guess, Julie's. This was her domain, I suppose, but you had to realize pretty quickly that you were going to run into this issue.
Yeah, I realized that pretty quickly, and I actually, Carrie Putnam, the CEO of the Sundance Institute, I'm on the alumni advisory board at Sundance, and Sean Bailey, the president of Disney Productions, is on the board of trustees, and so she put us together. And I went out there and I talked to Sean, and obviously he wasn't going to sign off on it right away, but Julie kept a relationship with Disney, and Julie and I went out there and we showed them clips of Disney Club and Graduation and these moments to all the heads of the different divisions of Disney. Sean had organized them in a meeting. It was the head of Disney Marketing and Disney Legal and Disney Animation. And I was a nervous wreck. And I remember this very clearly, that when I finished the presentation and the lights went up, they were in tears.
Oh, wow. That's good. Tears are good.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think they realized that their product, what they create, had changed the life, and that was something they hadn't anticipated, and I think they were very moved by that.
Yeah, it reinforces a whole lot. Yeah, that's a great experience for any documentary filmmaker. That's exactly the kind of results that you would ever hope for. That's right.
I mean, I think I've had many great experiences through the process of making this film and bringing this film to the world that I, you know, thank. I'm very thankful for as a thinker.
And so how did you come to partner up with Julie while we're on the subject?
With Julie?
Julie Goldman, yeah.
Julie produced God Loves Uganda.
Right.
And so we met a long time ago, way back before God Loves Uganda, at the Tribeca Film Festival. We met, I was in All Access, program called All Access. I was a grantee, and Julie was one of the advisors, and I told her about the film, and she signed on to produce it, and it was the beginning of a amazing partnership that has, you know, we've made a number of films together, and it's been a, you know, sort of great partnership working with her and Motto Films.
Well, the results of this film, Life Animated, you know, it's terrific. And like I said at the beginning, it works really well on a number of levels, and everybody will be very moved by it. But it's also just, you know, it's refreshing to see a documentary, there's been many documentaries that have dealt with autism, of course, but this is it's almost a comedy.
That's so great that you say that.
It's almost, let's expand because that. It's almost a musical comedy. Go ahead.
Yes. You know, I wanted to make a film that is not only sort of takes us into the world of someone living with autism, but also is like a joyous celebration of someone living with autism, and is uplifting and positive, and that is universal, and that drives people to the theater. I want people to go to the theater and experience this film in the theater. You know, bigger than life.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I there's no film that doesn't benefit from being seen on the full on the big movie screen, no matter how good your setup is and you're, you know, at home or whatever. I mean, everything does. I always feel like you should be smaller. You should be smaller than the screen. That's just my own,
yes,
my own philosophy.
Yeah, and I think having gone to film festivals across the country and played for audiences of 1,700 at True False, there was 1,700 people at Full Frame, 1,400 people at a Montclair with Stephen Colbert hosting the Q&A with 1,700 people. It really plays well in an audience, and it's this collective experience. And Owen has been thriving when at these film festivals and at these screenings. And there's a moment at Full Frame where 1,400 people are on their feet cheering, and Owen comes running down the middle aisle high-fiving people as he takes the stage, and he says, "I feel the love in this room."
It's just life-affirming. Tony Robbins, excuse me. It shames Tony Robbins. Another documentary, by the way, which...
Oh.
we'll be competing for audiences. So listen, I know we're winding down, but I wanted to what I was trying to get at, actually, just to backpedal a second, was that he's like an inspirational. Owen's kind of become an inspirational speaker in his own way.
Owen is inspirational and to so many people, you know. Whether we're screening at kids, high school kids,
yeah.
Some of our best screenings at Sundance was our high school screening at Sundance, who were so engaged, and they so get an understanding of kids who aren't neurotypical, but he's also like inspiring adults and inspiring families, because it's really, you know, this is really a coming of age story, a story about love and perseverance, and Owen. Is really an expert, a master on life, because he's mastered these sort of classic fables that mm-hmm. make up the character of a Disney animated film. It's really a classic fable retold. And Owen has mastered that, mastered life, and that's what connects us all as humans, our stories.
I'd love if after this, you know, you have some time, maybe it'll be toward the end of the year. I don't know when it'll be. Maybe you can come in. Where are you based? In New York, or are you based in? You're Brooklyn, right?
New York.
Yeah.
New York.
Well, yeah, because I'd love to have you back on. It's for me as well as I feel like our conversation is gone. It's easier for me. I just have a whole other, you know, sort of way.
Yeah,
it's so much nicer in person is what I'm trying
Absolutely.
To what I'm trying to say. So I'd love to have you come into this little, you know, our studio, and maybe we can talk again. And but it's really, really been terrific. Finally, I've been wanting to have you on since God Loves Uganda, and I'm really, really grateful for your
great.
Time considering.
Well, yeah, no, it was great to talk to you, and I'd be happy to come in to your studio.
sure, sure. All right, well, listen, I know you've only got a matter of days before your big theater. It's going to be in New York, and I assume, like, tons of other cities. So, but is it same day, or is it going to kind of open rippling across the state?
No, it's going to sort of, it's like a...
One big broad opening?
It's a tiered opening, so New York and L.A.
Oh,
on
is.
July 1st, and then
gotcha.
July 8th more cities, and July 15th more cities. And,
gotcha.
You know, and depending on people go out to the theater and see the film... The more cities it opens in.
Makes
so
sense.
I appreciate you getting the word out about it, spreading the word, and letting
you can count,
know that it's
you,
opening. And to well, go to the theaters.
You, right. Listen to Roger. Go to the theaters. All right. Well, I appreciate it. Thanks so much, and great talking to you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good talking to you.
Same
Bye.
Here. For you, the listeners of FilmWax Radio, Warby Parker is offering a free 5-day home try-on to give you the opportunity to check out their glasses. I personally love the idea of getting my frames sent to me at home so I can have all my friends survey the glasses with me and help me make my choice. But to get your home try-on today, go to warbyparkertrial.com/filmwaxradio. Again, That's warbyparkertrial.com/filmwaxradio for your free 5-day home try-on. Returning again, these are two guys that have been on different segments before of this podcast. We have the Joel Fendelman, who is the director of Remittance, and his producer, Frank Hall Green. And we're going to bring these guys on now. I know for a fact, if you're in the New York area, especially you guys on Long Island, this film Remittance is going to be at the Stony Brook Film Festival. So please do check the Stony Brook Film Festival for tickets. And I'm going to be there. And I know Charlotte's going to be there. Mm-hmm. And I know Kevin Davidson is going to be there, too, at the Stony Brook Film Festival. You're going to come with us?
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, my conversation with Joel and Frank.
Lord, nagpapasalamat po kami sa pagkain na to. Nagpapasalamat po kami dahil nandito po ang aming kapatid, si Marie. Sana po, pag siya ay bumalik, magiging safe din siya.
Passport.
Yung taxi. Kailangan magpadala ng pera para may paayos ko. Sino mo yan?
Pag kinausap ka nila, tawa ka lang. Wala naman silang pakialam kung nakikinig ka o hindi.
Okay, we're rolling. Okay.
What does he do with his finger? I don't understand.
Well, this I understand. Keep it going. Yeah. So hopefully Frank will get here soon. Frank?
Yeah, he should Frank be here in any minute. Okay. Any minute.
But we're talking with the returning Joel Fendelman.
Returning champion.
You were on at least 2.5 years, maybe, I don't know, how long ago? 2 years ago with the, yeah. When you were...
Yeah, I'm trying
had
to...
Had David, yeah. That was your film?
Yeah, it was a few years back. Yeah, probably 3 years ago. Yeah, something.
Well, it was when I was doing a bricks and mortar film series, I think we were trying to get
that.
That
was even a few years back.
No, that was when you had it at the Quad.
We were going to, it would have been great. We're going to have you do sort of host a session, but we decided not to do the four wall. And
that was smart.
I know you're sort of an advocate for not doing those things too. So
yeah, for sure. I mean, I think for low budget films to do, you know, that's not a good use of money. I mean, in the ideal, I understand you want to do a theatrical, though, so you do what you got to do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, and then you ended up coming on the podcast, and it was really good. I really enjoyed that time.
Thanks.
So it's great. Now, you have a new film, which I think you were touching on, if started coming back to me, because you were telling me you were in the Philippines,
mm-hmm.
and I was concerned for your safety, but for Filipino fans, and I don't speak Tagalog.
Me either.
Okay. I love the Filipino people, and I think I just went into experiencing technical difficulties here. It's okay, Alex. I'm good again. But it's the
this one's wonky. Because
it's okay. I'll leave it alone. I played with it. That was my problem. It's okay. Just when I plugged it all. Okay, it's good.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Alex Brazell. I'm so excited to mention him in every opportunity because I have a producer in here. Anyway, and you were talking about this film. That you were shooting the Philippines, and it's called Remittance, and it's fantastic. I really loved it.
Thank you.
You've really grown. I mean, I love David, too. I thought it was a very moving, simple mm-hmm. story. This is like another leap forward for you, I think.
Thanks.
Yeah. And what a great actress. What's the name of this actress that is the lead?
Well, her name is Angela Barrocha. And
whatever the Filipino Oscars are, I'm sure she swept them.
Yeah, well, she's actually not an actress.
I knew you were going to say that.
You set me up. Nice one. That was good. Yeah, she was just a live-in maid that we found through the casting process there. And
that's risky, isn't it?
Very risky. It was definitely our final callbacks were between her and then another wonderful actress who actually ended up playing her employer.
Right, she was great too.
And we were kind of going back and forth between which one to cast for the lead. And one of the sort of challenges or cons of working with mm-hmm. or choosing Alicia was the risk. You're working with an odd actor. You don't know what to expect. But we just kind of went with it.
Well, let's give a little bit of the synopsis for those listening, because it's just nice to have that context, right? It's a first of all, you shot the whole thing, the first little chapter, sort of setting up the film and why this character has to move to a wealthier part of the country, right? So she did. Was it outside Manila? Where was that part?
Yeah, well, she was Baguio City, is where north in the mountains.
Okay. It's far from where Philippines is a series of islands. She traveled some distance away from her family, and which was in a poor city, mm-hmm. to a wealthier area where she got work as a house cleaner for a wealthy family, and in order to make ends meet. And the film is really just about her adjusting to that in many ways, and then ultimately, do we want to say she returns?
Yeah,
It's okay that she ultimately decides late in the film to return back to her family because, you know,
circumstances.
Circumstances made her make that decision. That's the story. Again, it's not very complex, but it's just really – it's a nice – it has touches of neorealism, I thought.
Yeah. You know,
yeah.
Most – the cast are people we cast from real life.
Locals.
Yeah, locals. All her friends are non-actors from that. And it was – we wrote the script and then shaped the scenes and a lot of the dialogue and everything just by workshopping with these women.
Okay.
And
– how much time did you spend in the Philippines?
Well, so we spent about – we shot for a month in Singapore and then we took a month off. Then went to the Philippines and spent a month out there.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much just to give you the overall – timeline of it. I went down over to Singapore, spent 6 months writing the film with Patrick.
Mm-hmm.
He told me about this thing in Singapore, which half the population have live-in maids, and they all come from all these Southeast Asian poor countries to work there, and they work these really intense hours from 12 to 18 hours a day.
Is that where she went? She went and ended up going to work for these people in Singapore, right?
Yeah.
Now that you're saying, for some reason, I remembered that coming up in the film just now, and then I forgot about it. So it didn't make sense what I was saying before. So she went from a poor neighborhood in the Philippines to Singapore.
To Singapore. Yeah, it wasn't about it. Yeah, to Singapore.
Okay. That makes sense. That's, of course, much further.
Very modern city, Singapore.
Yeah, where you can't chew gum or something
Can't
like that.
Chew gum or spit.
Right, fine. Expectorate, because you
death
will...
penalty if you sell drugs.
Right, I mean,
it's intense.
Right. Well, and they should elect Donald Trump president. That sounds like a better fit.
It would be an interesting
fit. Right?
Yeah. Well, but on the other hand, it's a very wealthy country. Probably on the path to be the richest country in the world per capita. I mean, so there's certain elements.
Really? Well, they're saving all that gum money.
Exactly.
Must
exactly. But what's interesting there is on Sundays, all the workers or the lucky ones get the day off.
Mm-hmm.
So really it's a different town on a Sunday. All the public areas, the streets are taken over by migrant workers, hundreds of thousands of them.
That makes sense.
And they're really just having this a beautiful time, a beautiful experience for these couple hours or day that they have off.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as a Westerner where we have fortunately, more than just a day off or a couple hours or more freedom in that way.
Right.
You see this, you hear about this, and these women are just putting on their nice dress, having a picnic, and like the scenes you saw, those are just actual scenes from that. It's really inspiring, and that's what originally kind of got me interested in it when Patrick, my co-writer who lives out in Singapore, told me about this, co-director, and he said, man, it's a really beautiful thing. And I went out there and saw this experience. And so, man, we gotta tell a story about who are these women and men after they close the door, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we see a some level of it. I had a housekeeper growing up, and
where was that?
In Miami, and then you have someone, and we had a great relationship. All this, but you only see half the side of someone's life. You see a certain facade. But what happens when someone closes the door and they go in their room or they go home, and what's that life like? And that's where I think it gets interesting, and that's what we want to explore with the film.
I mean, films have always been, I mean, historically speaking, interested in the family and what's going on in their lives. Now we're looking at stories that are flipping this coin. We are more interested, at least in the independent film world, it seems like interested in the house cleaner story now.
Why is that, you think?
I was going to ask you why you feel like there was clearly an interesting story you were telling. Also, you were dropping little hints all along the way about turmoil in her employer's lives. This couple that she works for, they're a wealthy couple. They're interracial. For certain they are, because the wife is is she Filipino? Yeah. Or she's single?
She's Filipino, but that's
Filipino. And go ahead.
But so that's also her employer's Filipino, but she's of a different class in essence.
Yes, sure.
And that becomes sort of
the
a
1%.
Layer. Yeah, we're looking to explore. But she also gets, in her own way, gets stigmatized as being a Filipino and gets looked at and things like that. And there is that moment, that scene where they have sort of this bonding.
Yeah, it's very, very nice. And unexpected, another kudo to you for just not everybody. Like, she's a bit of an ice queen. I hate to use the term. It's a bit misogynist. But, now I can use it because I just sort of gave myself
freedom.
Free pass there. I'm very evolved and progressive. So she's the wife of her employer is a bit of an ice queen, and she's kind of almost abusive. She's kind of almost abusive to what's her name, the character?
Yeah, to Marie.
To Marie, excuse me. And then something, you can tell that she's like all of a sudden gets a little bit in a vulnerable moment. And Marie, very, she doesn't overdo it. Frank is here. Frank was the producer of the film.
Oh, my God.
There he is. Look at that.
Frank just happened to show up.
How did
up?
That happen?
Yeah. Just hang. Were you just in the neighborhood, Frank?
Yeah. Just tried to stop okay? by. How are you? High five.
Nice to see you.
Shakes.
Yeah.
Shakes. Hi.
Good to see you. I'll have to crane my neck a little bit to see you.
Frank Hall Green, you made everyone.
It, hi. Wait a minute. You were stabbed? No, I'm kidding. Oh, I apologize.
Let's not get off on that.
No, I'm sorry. I was debating how to come up with it. It's one of the best stories that's ever come up on this podcast. Unfortunately, at the risk of your life, I apologize. I just remembered that story as I was coming over here to the studio.
Well, Joel has fascinating stories about himself.
I know.
So we should stick to those. People can Google search my stabbing.
No, they can listen to the last episode.
Sorry,
you were on.
You
were on the show 2 falls ago, and you were a great guest. I was like, okay, I'll have the producer on. What the heck? And then he turns out to be an amazing guest, not so surprisingly. That's why I wanted you back on.
Right.
So, Frank, you produced.
I was director last time. Now I'm producer.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Well,
I was writer, director, producer last time. Right. But now I'm producing.
My memory of Woodstock 2014.
Yeah, Woodstock 2014.
2014.
Yeah, you interviewed Wildlike.
By the way, let's say it. It just came out on DVD and on streaming on demand.
Netflix.
Yeah. So we prefer you get it on Blu-ray or DVD.
Of course.
Or you can buy it on Apple TV.
I would love to get a copy of that movie. I love that
movie.
It
will come your way for sure. Consider
it
done.
I did. I saw it in IMAX. Yeah. It was amazing.
In IMAX?
Yeah, well, IMAX size screen at Austin Film Festival.
You're in Frank's basement, I see.
Yeah.
It's an IMAX.
I have an IMAX in my basement. It's amazing. There's only 3 huge lounge chairs for it. Only 3 people can watch it at one time. Because, you want in a private cinema, you want the chairs to be really, really comfortable and have food, amenities, and so forth. So once you get all that in there, it's really only room for 3, little standing room. But
yes. Well, I just came back from a trip to I was up in Vermont and then Massachusetts like a month ago. And on the way back, I stopped at my friend. He's a filmmaker named Alex Calvo and stopped at their home because it was literally on the way. That's Charlotte, who's interning for FilmWax Radio. And he invited me. I went to their home in this little suburb of New Haven. Maybe Hartford, I can't remember. He goes, come down and see the theater. And I went down, and it was unbelievable. It was incredible. And it cost him a very modest amount, considering. Yeah. It was like, I got to come back here. This is fantastic. Anyway, but Frank, Wildlike is available. I'm just going to get that out of the way. You can get it on various platforms, including, of course, with the Netflix, which is wonderful. Yeah. And it's a beautiful film with Bruce Greenwood, and it's just a terrific film. But we were talking about Remittance, which is Joel's film. And I really... also was so happy that it turned out to be good.
hostage in film. Yes.
Makes it so much less awkward when you're praising it.
Right.
And it's going to be at the Brooklyn Film Festival? Is
yeah.
that right?
Yeah, it should last should night, be. And it's showing
oh,
on...
Oh, it showed last... That's right. It's going on, and I'm
it's
just...
It's happening. And then it's shown Sorry. On Friday at Friday 8 o'clock eight. At the Wythe Hotel.
Oh, very
yeah.
good.
Oh, okay. The main, I'll try yeah, the main venue.
I'm going to try to come by.
Friday night, Joel and I will be there to do a Q&A.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very unique, as you know now, having seen it, it's a unique picture.
I it mean, is.
It's very real to life.
I called it neorealist.
Yeah, I mean, tradition... it's even beyond that. You know, it's, you know, and...
How so?
I always say that Joel and Patrick are sort of these anthropological filmmakers. It's like they're, you know, they're really, they take the time to study and mm-hmm. go into the community. And a lot of filmmakers do that. But, I mean, this is in a way that is pretty hardcore, you know, where they go through basically a documentary experience
yep,
with their true. Subjects and in their environment. And they just basically, you know, story out and refilm, mm-hmm. you know, a lot based on those real experience. And, of course, using many of the real characters. Mm-hmm. So it's a real, you know, migrant worker from the Philippines who has her own story.
Yeah, it's very true. It is very influenced, I would say. I can't say it was influenced, but it reminded me of documentary in your approach to it, you know, aspects of it. I could easily have seen this been a documentary, but
originally we thought, and when Patrick was telling me about the idea, mm-hmm. it was originally pitched as
Patrick,
a documentary.
Patrick is who?
So Patrick Daly is who lives in Singapore, and he co-wrote and co-directed the film with mm-hmm. me.
Okay, yeah.
And so we talked about it as a documentary at first, and then. Decided to go more to fictionalize it.
I also mentioned to Joel that I thought casting, you know, non-professional actors was very, very risky and brave. And it worked, of course, it ended up working out beautifully because the cast is all of the people on that.
Yeah.
Really were great. I mean, there's not a flawed.
Well, I think I think you and Pat go through the same auditioning experience. You know, they take the steps necessary to.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure that the people can bring the performances to film. You know, the added advantage is that they very much look the part because they are in reality. And then also that they bring the experience and the feelings, you know, truthfully to the screen. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it was wonderful. So when did you finish shooting the film?
It was a few years back. I mean, the post-production took a bit just... You know, little
when we met last time, were you were going back and forth?
Yeah,
were you?
2014, right?
Yeah, we shoot in 2014.
Yeah,
okay. Might have been. Yeah, and then
you might have been in that due diligence period
yeah.
when we were
maybe yeah
we met over his last film, David.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah,
very good. And so is this the premiere or just a New York premiere or
the New York premiere?
Just mm-hmm. the New York premiere. Yeah,
yeah. So it's screened.
It's been playing around a lot.
I bet it's great.
Winning awards.
Sweeping various awards.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's shown in the Philippines next month, which I'm quite excited about.
That's fantastic.
Because I think it'll speak to people worldwide, but right. really speak to people in the Philippines. And that's...
I assume you would love to make a social impact here.
Yeah, I think... yeah. I'm curious what social... A lot, because it's interesting, because the life that the domestic worker lives in Singapore... or in any of these countries like Hong Kong or Dubai where lots of migrant workers travel, I don't think is the family back home doesn't know about this life. They mm-hmm. don't understand this life. And that's a point of conflict for the women who are there because they don't understand what they're going through.
Well, even just humanizing
yeah,
these people is making social impact, isn't it? I mean,
I think anytime taking the other... And,
which was what I was trying to get at
yeah,
before we were
yeah, exactly.
rudely interrupted by Frank Serrano.
Yeah, whether it's the housekeeper or whatever person in your life that we only see one side of, if we can take a two-dimensional character in our lives and make them three-dimensional, right. all of a sudden we see they're just like us.
It was like Marie, the main character again of Remittance. She was not only invisible in many settings when she was at work, but she almost she understood it on a very basic level. I'm supposed to remain invisible. When she had this confrontation, the positive confrontation, if there is such a thing, with her employer, the mm-hmm. the woman, the mm-hmm. wife, where the wife was in a vulnerable moment, sort of extended herself to Marie. Even there, she didn't go overboard with like some sort of, well, you know, thank you, and I'm here if you need, you know, all that stuff that you kind of are used to hearing. There wasn't that moment. It was more just, Yes, ma'am. You know, it was a very to me that's much more realistic than what your heart and your more sentimental side is hoping. Like, oh, maybe this is a, you know, they're gonna
bond.
I don't know. Yeah, they're gonna bond, and this is gonna change. But and there's also a scene which I don't want to go into detail, but she caught she had some information that could have been very, you know, but she knew that could be something that in another film maybe could have been somehow, you know, different choices could have made, and mm-hmm. yet, you know, I thought she realized she needed to be invisible mm-hmm. in those moments.
There's a lot at stake for these women there.
Right.
It's a tremendous amount of – they had to pay to get there. Their whole family and extended family is counting on them for this, so they don't want to get fired.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's all driven by fear. I mean, in Marie's life, she is saying, okay, I'm going to be – active and assertive in getting this position and getting this job and doing this migrant work and sending money, remitting money home. But everything else, I'm going to be completely passive and, you know, do as I'm told, because I just – all I need is this money and mm-hmm. to send it home. Mm-hmm. That's my one objective. Everything else, you can abuse me. You can treat me however you want. I just want to accomplish making this money and sending it home. So, you know – I think it speaks to the sort of servitude of the position.
And it's also about a woman who comes to her own and finds her
exactly.
voice.
Right.
And then, by the end of it, she is, regardless of still having to deal with lots of conflicts in her life, she's way beyond. I mean, she's really evolved into a much stronger and self-dependent individual.
Yeah, I think she realizes she has other choices and options beyond, you know, one or two.
Yeah. Which seems to be a big mental part of the trappings of that's not the right word, part of an oppressed life is mental, you know, because mm-hmm. we sort of trap ourselves. Oh, I don't have choices. I don't, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. I'm locked into this thing. But sometimes you realize, oh, maybe not always the case. Maybe there are some. I just don't know what I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't.
It's
I
an
haven't.
Education.
Nobody's told me that I can. I have choices.
A lot of these women
I'm only told I don't have choices.
Yeah, they'll come from, like Marie or Angela, the actual actor, came from a small farm town, never had
internet. Now she's a movie star.
Now she's, well, that's why a lot of women like to move to Singapore. It's actually like, whoa, look at all these modern life that exists and access to a little bit higher level of living in some regard.
Well, even on the level of romance, she realizes that she has options.
Right.
Which is also very important.
Right.
You know.
My point is just what's especially unique and rewarding about viewing remittance is that with every turn where you think it's going to go in a direction, it sort of doesn't quite go there. It goes somewhere slightly different, which is both appropriate and pleasant surprise, you know, that it doesn't take these predictable
It's interesting. That was I have to give a nod to Frank on that, because we were writing the script. He kept saying that to us. We were throwing him drafts. He's like, just whatever you do, just take us to some place that we wouldn't expect.
Right.
The next scene, make it unexpectable.
And but without it being contrived.
Without it being, yeah.
Yeah.
Keep it fresh.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so what's the next? Okay, so Friday, this Friday, and God, I don't know when this show will post. I'm going to try to get it done immediately. But what's next with it? Where is it going next?
So after Brooklyn, it's going to show at Stony Brook.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's
a
Long
great
Island.
Festival. Yeah, have you been there?
I have not been there, but
you got to go.
I will.
Alan, who runs that festival, I mean, it's been running for forever. It's a huge festival. Like, wildlife screen there in front of 650 people.
Oh, my God.
That's incredible.
They have an amazing audience.
They're starved out there in Nassau County. Or is it Nassau County?
Yeah, it's a great town. It's a great weekend. They put you up. He's awesome.
They have money.
It's a great group.
They have money.
Yeah. And submission to the festival is free.
That's incredible.
It's an amazing festival.
Is it through the university or is it separate? Oh, that's why.
Alan, who runs the festival, also runs the Arts Center at Stony Brook, which I don't remember the name of the Arts Center, but he's very much in the theater and so forth.
When is this?
It's in the middle of the summer, July?
Well, yeah, July. End of July.
Well, yeah. I'll just come out for that.
Yeah.
Come on out. I think Patrick might be down.
It's worth going.
Uh-huh. I will go. I'm always looking for, you know, I've gone to the Montclair. That was a nice festival.
Mm-hmm.
I've been going there. And because every year I try to hit a couple of new ones, and if it's local, and I would consider that local.
Yeah.
That's great.
Stony Brook was one of my
favorites. And that Hamptons, they're so highfalutin out there, for God's sakes. Why don't you travel like a half the distance and have twice the good time?
Right. See, and 10 times the
you
audience.
You could see the, by the way, if you're from the Hamptons, you're listening, that was a joke. I'm still planning on coming. Okay, so it'll be in Midsummer. Check, where can people go? We should have done this.
Woods Hole. It's going to Woods Hole.
It's going to Woods Hole.
Oh, that's, I have that's a friend out there.
Uh-huh.
That's in Massachusetts. One. That's at the end of, all the way out at the end of Cape Cod, mm-hmm. right? I have a friend who runs that festival. Or he's, no, they were telling, I just heard about this festival. It's supposed to be very good.
It is, yeah.
When is that one?
July, end of July or August.
Okay, fuck Stony Brook. I'm going to go to Woodhull.
No, no, no.
Actually, they're both great festivals.
I bet.
Yeah.
I bet.
Yeah, are you, you're going to, has Julian Dubuque already happened?
Yeah, that happened.
All right,
yeah.
I'm going to make a note here because I'll forget.
It's on, people can go on the website and our lengthy growing list of festivals is on
there. What's the website?
Remittancefilm.com.
Remittancefilm.com. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then the Woodhull. You know, I'm going to, I have a childhood friend who I grew up with in Queens, and his name is Matthew Barton. So it's out there. And he's out in Woodhull, and he works a job, but I know it has to do with like marine life. That's so terrible. Hmm. But it's, he works, so he's, you know, and he lives out in Cape Cod, and he was telling me about the Woodhull just like 6 months ago. So I'm going to make a note to myself. That's a nice trip. That'll be a nice trip, and maybe for like a long weekend or something in July, late July. Okay, so that's great. So people go to remittancefilm.com. You're on Facebook, I assume, the whole mm-hmm. nine yards mm-hmm. and everything else.
Yeah.
Frank, what's going on? What else have you got coming up? You're a busy guy. So
I'm doing a lot of producing. My partner Tom and I are doing a lot of development on some bigger projects. But Joel and I have recently agreed to join forces again, and I'm going to produce his next film, which we'll keep under wraps for now.
Sure.
So yeah, we're going to get into that. And at some point, I might direct something else.
You should. Wild Like Again is a terrific piece of work, and it's a strongly directed film.
Thanks.
And yeah, but I guess if you have Bruce Greenwood, you can't go too wrong, of course, there, right?
Yeah, I mean,
he's an amazing actor. And he was such a lovely guy. Oh, just anytime he wants to come back,
he's
that'd
a nice
be great,
guy.
Too.
Yeah.
Everywhere. He's everywhere.
He's everywhere and everything. Working.
Yeah, I mean, what's the series? He's like on the biggest series. He keeps ending up on.
Yeah, he jumped into Mad Men at the
Mad
end
Men.
There.
Yeah.
God, they loved it.
That was fantastic.
People loved it.
That was great.
Yeah.
What a great role. Anyway, I'm getting off.
Anyway,
off,
and
of
Joel
Corsica.
Joel decided to step back and go into the film school at Austin, and teach the other students how to be film students.
What?
You know,
is this
a grad
part film
of the
program?
State University or what?
Yeah, I'm at UT.
UT?
Finishing up my master's there.
Okay,
he's getting his master's in film, and he, you know, what do you now? So now you're like in shorts world, and he had short mm-hmm. in Tribeca, and
you did,
yep.
Yeah.
And he's got
you're not keeping in touch.
He's got fantastic new shorts in between his feature career.
Yeah,
so.
It's too easy a pun. I'm
it's
not going to go
easy.
There.
Yeah.
let's look up. Charlotte, can you look up, or Alex and Charlotte, can you look up what episode Frank Hall was on with Bruce Greenwood, Frank Hall?
Might want to add Green. It may come
Frank Hall
faster.
Green, excuse
yeah.
me.
Yeah.
No, you never fix anything in post. You say that, but you never
and
do.
And then you hit a start, mark in, mark out, yeah. and you shoot it up to the web.
I don't make a lot of mistakes. Can't tell you.
You're doing a neorealistic.
Or... Mm-hmm. 31 episode. I haven't made 431 episodes. 314 episode 314. All right, folks.
That
so
was a winner.
We'll edit this one. So go to episode number 314, and you can hear Frank Hall Green on that show as well, which is a really good show. Also, because I'm looking like an asshole here. What is Joel Fendelman's last episode? Can you look up that? That's still online, I think. I took off a lot of old episodes, but I know those two shows are still up. But you can hear that episode, and Frank has an incredible, I mean, you know, besides this talk about his films, I mean, that
his
is
incredible
a remarkable
voice.
Story, and you opened up very, very frankly, and I appreciate it about that incident that happened to you. But it is a remarkable story.
Yeah.
So that's 314. And what was Joel Fendelman's last episode? Well, no, we don't have to stand.
It's like a scene from Remittance when they're doing the.
I have this option now. I appreciate
numbers.
It. Yeah. Oh right. That's right.
Was that Morse code?
I know. It's the beauty part of having a producer, and it's just like a dream come true. Before I would always have to do everything on my own, and Now I have help. It's right. A beautiful thing.
Yeah. You know? Not fast help,
two,
but it's
one,
help.
Four. Is that true? 214? That's a long time ago.
You have 100.
You were 314?
David was quite a while ago.
Or 341. Yeah. What did I just say?
314.
You were 314 and he's right. On 214? Yeah. Interesting.
You're a busy man. That's what's going
we're
on.
We're up to 355 or something. 350 episode. Yeah, it's going fast. So what happened here last time is, you know, Muhammad Ali died.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like somebody I grew up with. I mean, I'm a little older than either of you. And he was there, like, you know, the most famous person in my childhood growing up. I mean, sure. Hands down. And so when he died, I felt like a part of me died, a small part of me. This is not about me. But it does feel that way when somebody that's been there your entire life and who's as huge a presence is gone. You feel like, ugh. That, you know, every time that happens now, I feel, you know, shaken by it. And so I reached out to Leon Gast, who directed When We Were Kings. Did you see that documentary?
It's a fantastic documentary.
Isn't it? It's one of the best ever made.
Mm-hmm.
Leon got the Oscar for that. You know, he's in Woodstock, speaking of Woodstock.
Great.
He lives there,
yeah.
And comes every year, but I never see him. I've only gone twice, but I've never seen him. So finally, I just decided to, you know, really get a little aggressive. I figured he's probably being overwhelmed with emails and calls to talk about Ali, but I just thought, let me give it a shot.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, yes, tomorrow, dial in, and I was coming to the studio. So we made it happen, and
that's amazing.
And I've edited it. It's ready to go today.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It's great. And then the other guy was another documentary, not quite as famous a documentary. It's called The Trials of Muhammad Ali. It's a really good film. It's all archive, I believe. And Bill Siegel, this guy. So today they were both going to Louisville to the funeral. So, but Bill got back to me today, and he said, "Sorry, I didn't get back to you." I'm like, "Of course, I understand." And he's going to be. He said he would after he gets back.
Yeah.
So well, I'll be able to get.
Yeah.
I really love the idea.
Well, speaking of current events, now that we have a female presidential nominee,
yes.
You should go into the war room. Whoever did that doc.
It was Pennant Baker and Hegedus, and I just did a live show with them.
There you go.
Because they have a new documentary.
Right.
And I just did a live podcast with T.A. Pennant Baker and Chris Hegedus. Mm. They're probably traveling a little bit with their new documentary. It's called Unlocking the Cage. And it just came out.
Yeah, I saw that.
And they did The War Room together. It was like their first big film when they started making films together. Because, of course, Pennant Baker had been making films for decades before. Meeting Chris Hegedus, and then they got together, and they made lots of stuff. But her for quite a while, she was basically taking things that he had made but never finished, edited and finished, and so she was doing that. I think The War Room might have been their first real co-production as co-filmmakers, and that was another one of the best documentaries. Ever.
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah. I love The War Room, and I actually saw that in Washington D.C. on a visit.
Oh, that's a just great
came out
spot.
At the same time. Yeah,
that's nice.
Interesting the way that worked out. Anyway, you have a bunch of different projects, but
speaking of female presidential nominees,
by the way?
Well, one of the people that ran for president in 1972 was Shirley Chisholm, African American female, and she has been a tribute. She was actually in the video last night. If you watched Hillary's video prior to her acceptance speech, was a sort of dedicated to women and women in politics, and Chisholm was probably the face that you saw more than anyone in that video. Right. And I am producing a project about
a narrative?
Chisholm,
because there's a wonderful
project.
Documentary. Of course.
There is a wonderful documentary, Chisholm 72, about the campaign, and she's a fascinating woman, and came from absolutely zero, growing up literally bare feet, barefoot,
to being so poised and intelligent and
breaking many glass ceilings.
Yeah, exactly. Like to the point where it's like, how far ahead of time can you be? She's just like, how did you exist and get where you are in 1972?
Yeah.
It's a remarkable story.
It is.
Shirley
Chisholm. It needs to be told.
Right. Yes, agreed. I also just had on the show just the other day another remarkable true story, which is The Witness, which is about the, Kitty Genovese story, which is a local story from where I grew up in Queens, about a woman who was coming home late at night. This is in 1964, and she was brutally stabbed to death. Mm. And the whole thing was that all the people that lived right in front of her apartment building, by the way, and all of the people that were woken from her blood-curdling screams. Nobody. This was the story.
The famous,
this wasn't
this
the reality.
Was the story, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, of course, it turns out that that wasn't quite the truth. There were people that tried to help her, but that's not how it was reported. That's not the public narrative at the time. So her brother, who is still alive and well, got together with this filmmaker, and they together made this remark. It was going to start as a narrative film, but then the brother, it was clear it was a documentary. It's a very, very powerful documentary called The Witness, and it just opened this past Friday. So they came on and did the show, the two of them, and I was really – I grew up on just blocks away from where this, so it was part of the lore of the neighborhood, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a really remarkable story.
I want to see that.
Yeah, you should. So now what I got there's a narrative version coming out.
Oh, great.
That's supposed to come out in the fall. It's unauthorized in the sense that it doesn't have the participation of the Genovese family, I don't think. Mm-hmm. But it's another story that 52 years later is being told again also.
I think it still holds relevance, especially for us in New York, when to engage, when not to engage, you know, all that stuff.
Well, did people come to your aid when you were
There wasn't really anyone around. There was one person who did ask me if I was okay. It's a long story, but there wasn't really anyone around though.
Right, which is partly how it happened in the first place.
Yeah.
Probably. Right?
But one time I got my iPhone taken from me. I was on the phone and a rollerblader came by and just grabbed the iPhone and took off. In Washington Square Park.
You're teaching people how to steal, by the way.
Really?
If you're going to get an iPhone, this is the way to do it. Especially because it was in the summer and I had flip-flops on. So I'm chasing this guy in flip-flops yelling, stop this guy, stop this guy.
Right. Oh, that's
and great. Everyone's just, you know, these New Yorkers just turn around and be like, oh, what's the ruckus? Oh, another crazy person, you know, whatever. Meanwhile, this guy's taking off with my iPhone. So that's... You know, in New York, you don't really – if someone yells, stop thief, you don't really jump to action. You kind of first look and observe because you're suspicious.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Any close calls, close brushes there, Joel?
Any aiding? Any
since my 11:30 didn't show up.
Any Samaritan
no texts?
Activities?
They're here? Oh, I'm keeping them waiting? Oh. They're out there? What? They're here? Oh no! Let's
they're warming
wind
up.
Down. Then I'm sorry. I didn't know. I'll
leave the stories for next time.
Okay, but you promised to come on next time, Joel. Okay. You'll be a regular.
We'll be back with
guys.
Joel's next movie.
Seriously. Okay. Great. Well, I really loved having you guys back on. You're both terrific.
Thanks for reaching out to both of us.
Oh, my pleasure. Again, at the Brooklyn Film Festival, I'll do my best to edit this so when you're listening to me, I'm not talking about the Brooklyn Film Festival 2017. Okay, and. At Stony Brook, look at the website for RipMittensFilm.com to find out about Stony Brook and Wood Hull in Massachusetts coming up later this summer. Guys, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Take care.
Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. Of course, you're a subscriber to the podcast. I know that much, right? You are,
yes.
Aren't you?
Yes.
Oh, usually I just listen to the voices in my head. Though you are not voices in my head, are you guys?
We're real. We're here in the studio live.
In the Showbriz podcast. Showbriz Studios.
Live at Filmwax.
No, live at Showbriz Studios.
Well, live at Showbriz.
On the Filmwax radio show, We have to make that stipulation. Thank you, Alex Brazell, and thank you to the Showbriz Studios here in the East Village in New York City. Thank you to the listeners. Again, please subscribe. If you're not subscribed, you can go to iTunes or we're on Stitcher. And if you're at iTunes at the store, you go into the store and search Filmwax or Filmwax Radio. And this is what guys spread this around, by the way. And when you get to the Filmwax Radio page, there's the option to give us a star rating. Well, I urge you to give us a star rating because every time everybody gives a star rating, we move slightly up the ranks to be more searchable and findable on iTunes, which is really important for a podcast. So please, please, please do that. And you have an opportunity also to give us a little comment If you put anything negative in there, somehow there's setup where it just immediately deletes. So I apologize in advance for that. So just write something positive and save yourself some time. That's really what I'm trying to say. Just write something positive. And we're on Facebook, of course, under facebook.com/FilmWaxRadio. I'm trying to do a little William Shatner. And we're on Facebook at facebook.com/FilmWaxRadio. Oh, very good. Thank you. And at Twitter, at
FilmWax Radio.
Instagram?
FilmWax Radio.
Tumblr? We don't have a Tumblr account. What are you, nuts? Oh, come on, get serious.
Throw me one. I know the answer now.
I think we've run out of social media platforms. Wow. But,
well, this has been a delight. And it was very nice to hang out with Adam and Charlotte and Kevin Davidson.
thank you, guys.
At the FilmWax Radio Hour.
It is an hour. Thank you, guys, so much. And you'll come back, right? And
sure.
Doing more of these?
Sure.
Thank you very much. Thank you guys for listening. Okay. This has been your host of FilmWax Radio, episode number 359. I'm your host, Adam Shartoff. Until next time, God bless.